Welcome, everybody. The title of this conversation, shall I say, is going to be starting the conversation about bowel urgency in patients with Crohn's disease. I know typically people are used to seeing bowel urgency in patients with ulcerative colitis, so we're going to change this now and really focus on the sort of introduction of this concept in patients with Crohn's disease, and Millie's done a lot of work in this as well. Just as a reminder that this is a program that is supported by an educational grant by Lilly, and also that CME Outfitters is a joint accreditation provider and as such develops and certifies continuing education activities for the team, by the team, including our program today. That's not mine, that's theirs. I guess I should introduce myself. I am Marla Davinsky from Mount Sinai in New York, and I'm really delighted to be joined here by Dr. Millie Long and Dr. Tosif Ali, and I'm going to let them introduce themselves as I pull up their credits here.
Hey, thanks, Marla. I'm Tosif Ali. Hello, everyone. I am a medical director at SSM Health Crohn's and Colitis Center in Oklahoma City, where I practice and take care of IBD patients.
And I'm Millie Long. I'm at University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, where I also practice in our IBD center and direct our fellowship as well for UNC in gastroenterology and hepatology.
Well, we've got folks who are on the ground doing this kind of work, so thank you both for joining me. So just as a reminder about our learning objectives, of course, which is to recognize the frequency of bowel urgency in patients with Crohn's and the impact on the patient's quality of life. How do we incorporate these assessments of bowel urgency as part of our evaluation for patients with Crohn's and engage patients in open communication of their bowel urgency as part of shared decision-making? But I think Dr. Ali is going to walk us through really how do we think about urgency in our patients and sort of what are the approaches. Before we actually start digging into the meat or the content that Millie's going to start with, I do want to remind you why we're here. This is why we're here. So I'm going to have you meet our patient who's going to remind us about why we get up every day and do what we want to do and why everybody else in the room also gets up every day to do what they want to do, which is change the lives of the patients we treat.
I'm McCall McCarty. I'm a senior at OU. I'm an acting major with a communications minor. The spring of 2021, I got terribly sick. I started to get like these canker sores in my mouth. Eating was absolutely horrible. Literally just drinking water burned. I went to the emergency room and they did a scan of my body and they realized that I was so incredibly inflamed. I had sores covering every inch of my insides, literally from my mouth to my rectum. And so that's when they realized that I was actually in like the height of a Crohn's flare and I had absolutely no idea that Crohn's was even a disease.
See how emotional she got just talking about remembering it. Is that your patient?
Yeah.
Okay. Really important because I think she was having a little bit of reminding herself of how sick she was, and I think that itself really also is important for us to remember how this disease impacts the patients. But so first we're going to just do audience response here. You won't show the results. We'll come back and circle back at the very end to see whether or not our conversation has actually changed the way we incorporate bowel urgency assessments. So the question as stated is how often do you incorporate bowel urgency assessments into your evaluation of patients with Crohn's disease? There's no right or wrong answer. Wonderful. Let's dive into the case because I think it's impossible to really understand urgency in this totality without actually understanding how do patients present and what types of patients. I'd say that everybody assumes that you only have urgency when you have active rectal disease. I could swear that would probably be something for the last 30 years or so we've thought about, and here we are going to have a conversation that's nothing like that. Mm-hmm. And I think the Crohn's story blows that whole theory out of the water. And I remember seeing some of the data for the first time, Millie. I was like, this is impossible. This is a UC patient, right? So it even really struck me about understanding. So this is Susie M., who's a 28-year-old female patient. She was diagnosed with Crohn's disease 2 years ago. Her initial treatment, as usual, is steroids and a non-approved therapy for Crohn's disease, which is 5-ASA, finally continued to be symptomatic, and someone actually said, let me put you on an effective therapy that's actually approved. Funny enough. Anyway, so she had been placed on infliximab. Here's her dosing. But I think what's important and the purpose of really this discussion are her three statements, because I think it really sets the stage. So she's telling us that you may think I'm fine with all measures that you measure and tell me I'm in remission. I don't even know what that means. Your remission is not my remission. So what does she tell us? She says, I can't make it through a shift at work without using the bathroom. Mm-hmm. And 2 days ago, she was told she was in deep remission. So funny, right? So the same conversations. I feel fatigued from having to wake up at night. And I used to love going out with my friends, but it really involves so much uncertainty. I do not know when I'm going to have an episode of urgency. How am I going to go out? How am I going to go on a date? How am I going to sit at a restaurant? I mean, I'm elaborating on Susie's thought process, but I think that's sort of the message. And I'm better off just staying in, right? So the isolation has set in. She's telling us what she needs. And it made sense. Her first colonoscopy had active inflammation. I could see you being tired, but she had ileal ulcerations. Her rectum and her colon was actually completely normal. So again, this is what really changes the dialogue, is our understanding. And then we walk out of the colonoscopy suite and we're like, great news, Susie, is you have complete mucosal healing. And she's like, yeah, but I don't go out. How pleasurable or how happy am I about this news that you just gave me? I think really understanding that. So we're going to just get one more audience response. And again, there's no right or wrong answer. And I think this is how we conceive and how we think about it. So this was just to sort of see how we all think around this topic. So what do we all believe is true regarding bowel urgency in patients with Crohn's specifically? Wonderful. And we'll come back again because we're just wanting to dig into sort of this conversation and think a little bit more about our preconceived ideas mm-hmm. of urgency. And this here is just a framework, really, to just think about how would we think about in current times where we're understanding that we need to think about urgency. And both my friends here are going to walk through the elements. But I think the slide is to say, all right, how do you measure it, if you even do, other than do you have it, yes, no, which is pretty well how most of us were asking and continue to this day, but hopefully after today, that's going to change. And then do they have controlled or not controlled inflammation? If the answer is they have controlled inflammation, but they still report urgency, that's where you come in, really, and you're going to help us through that. Versus no, I think all of us are easily say, all right, we just need to optimize your therapy. No brainer. Doesn't mean we're going to solve the urgency problem. So again, there's that disconnect. So Millie, why don't you go through and start to explain the impact of this symptom on Crohn's patients?
Perfect. Absolutely. And we actually have more and more data on this, and it's one of the reasons we wanted to bring this program to you so you could see the most current data and hopefully apply some of this into your practice. But I think importantly, we're also going to hear from McCall again, who's going to tell us in her own words a little bit about this symptom impact. So when we think about the unmet needs in Crohn's disease, there obviously are a number. We're not yet at personalized therapy for each individual with Crohn's disease. We certainly need to do better with risk stratification, with individualizing treatment for patients. We certainly have a therapeutic ceiling. We're not yet at the therapy that will treat everyone with Crohn's disease. And sequencing is an area where we need further data. If you start on X, you have less of a response to Y. How do we decide that sequencing now that we actually have more and more novel therapeutics? We also need to better understand special populations, whether that be young individuals or pregnant patients or patients with comorbidities. We certainly need improved monitoring strategies, non-invasive strategies to help us to understand response at various time points. And something very important for both us, our healthcare system, and our patients, what is the role of de-escalation? But what we'll be focusing on today is one of these other unmet needs, which is really restoring quality of life for our patients, and how can we do better in terms of that? And we're going to show some data that actually was really eye-opening the first time that I saw some of these data. So when you look here, this was a study recently published in the American Journal of Gastroenterology that looked at the proportion of patients with Crohn's disease reporting bowel urgency. And when you look here, you can see it was actually stratified by TNF versus non-TNF, whether at enrollment 6 months or 12 months. And rather than focusing on the stratification, I think I want to emphasize that regardless of the therapy they're on, you're seeing that urgency is persisting over the course of a year for our patients. The worsening of bowel urgency symptoms certainly was there regardless of the treatment, whether it's 6 months to 12 months, we're not seeing benefit. So this is an area, it's an unmet need, where we can help to really improve the quality of life for our patients. So what are the symptoms with the most impact in our patients with Crohn's disease? Really, the big three are fatigue, pain, and bowel urgency. And unfortunately, we don't have great strategies specific to each of these outside of controlling the inflammation. But we're going to try to give you a toolbox for helping to manage the bowel urgency tonight. Certainly, these factors have multiple aggravators. They can be relentless. They can be unpredictable. And often that's what's hardest for our patients, just not knowing when that next shoe will drop in terms of increasing symptoms, and really can have a far-reaching negative impact, whether that's in their mental health, their relationships, their work or school performance, or really social isolation and stigma. And the uncertainty and the requirement for constant planning and adaptation really requires the patient to always be in a focus on their disease. And so we really want to improve this. And what do we mean by the symptoms our patients are having and the impact on their quality of life? I think that I really learned a lot from the CONFIDE survey, which actually was just published last year. And when you look, whether in the U.S. or in Europe, you can see that bowel urgency was among the top three most frequently reported Crohn's disease symptoms. Really? That's really just not something I would have thought in my practice. We really associate Crohn's disease with pain, altered bowel frequency, but not necessarily urgency. But when you look here, we're looking at, you know, 3/4 of patients who are experiencing this. And so it's something that we really need to address. And that number is high even amongst those receiving advanced therapies. Use of advanced therapy, you're still looking at over 50% of patients with bowel urgency. So when you look a little bit more specifically, you can see here how frequently, at least once per month, over 3/4 of patients with bowel urgency. Almost 2/3 of patients with bowel urgency-related accidents. And this one was the one that kind of hit me, I think, the hardest. And I know Marla and I have talked about this, but I didn't routinely ask my patients about this, but I've been surprised now that I've actually started that the majority of our patients actually require some sort of diaper or pad or protection associated with bowel urgency at least once per month. So that's really kind of groundbreaking to think that our patients are having to think about this and putting on protection to be able to leave the house. So this is just as much an issue in patients with Crohn's disease as it is in ulcerative colitis, and we need to bring it into our discussions. So what are those discussions? I think CONFIDE did a nice job of looking at what healthcare providers thought and compare that to what patients thought. And interestingly, healthcare providers were not very good about proactively discussing this with our patients. And when we looked at reasons why, most of us felt that we expect the patient, they should bring this up when you look over on the right side. Or maybe we don't have enough time and there are other things, they may be a little bit uncomfortable, but it's really, well, this should be brought up by the patient. But what's the problem? The patients aren't bringing it up because of various factors, including embarrassment. I'll show you some of those numbers. But this is really, really common. And when we think about what we as healthcare providers are traditionally asking about, it's diarrhea, pain, and blood and stool. But that's not really what's bothering our patients. That's not really what's limiting their involvement in their lives and really limiting their quality of life. I've actually had patients kind of chide me for this. When I ask them about blood, they're like, well, that doesn't matter. You know, that's really not what they are most concerned about. So why are they not bringing this up? Actually, embarrassment was the most common reason. 73% of patients were not bringing this up, even though they had urgency, because they just didn't feel comfortable discussing this. And only 40% of U.S. and 27% of European patients really actually felt completely comfortable bringing this up with their healthcare providers. So we need to circle this back to us, and this needs to be part of our inventory of what we're asking our patients. So what about daily activity? How does IBD impact that? Almost 80% of patients report that it limits their physical activity. 1/3 really avoid running or jogging. And what are those reasons? There's some fatigue in there, a concern about disease flare-ups. But again, 61% We're concerned about going and exercising and having increased toilet urgency. And this is a problem. Exercise impacts mental health. Exercise, in fact, we've done a study in our IBD Partners cohort that exercise is actually protective of relapse, like if you can actually have a patient exercise. And so this really impacts our patients. What are the reasons for avoiding? This was a nice survey that looked at everything from joint pain, abdominal pain, disease flare-up, but really lack of toilet access is really in there, you can see, and embarrassment, these factors where they don't want to participate in aspects of life. So how do they adapt? You can see here that many patients actually avoid, this is what they avoided. And really running and jogging is at the top of that list. And so patients are avoiding that lack of access to toilets. Sexual health, another topic that we're not very good at as healthcare providers about bringing up with our patients. But sexual functioning, satisfaction, and sexual drive can really be negatively impacted by inflammatory bowel disease and can impact a patient's quality of life. So this was a survey of almost 500 gastroenterologists. 70% never or rarely asked about sexual dysfunction. 75% did not change treatment if a patient reported sexual dysfunction. And what were the barriers? Lack of knowledge was the primary one. Lack of experience, lack of time, and even embarrassment. So really providing us with resources to be able to address this and have support for our patients becomes very important. And what is one thing we could do? We could address urgency because urgency has a huge impact on sexual activity. When you look at the top row, patient-provided reasons for avoiding or decreasing sexual activity, urgency is at the top. And so this is one way we can help our patients with concerns about sexual activity and sexual dysfunction. When you look at patients who avoided or decreased sexual activity in the last 3 months, it's really over half of our patients, and so this is impacting every other patient that we're seeing in clinic. This next study was a study that we did in our IBD Partners cohort. So IBD Partners is an internet-based registry of patients really living all over the world with inflammatory bowel disease, whether that be Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis. And the MUSIC study looked at characteristics of patients with and without bowel urgency, and looked at associations here and there. I'll show you some associations with other quality of life factors next. But essentially, in this population of almost 2,000 patients with Crohn's disease, you'll see that prior surgery, prior hospitalization, and certainly remission was associated with bowel urgency. In fact, in the overall cohort, over half of patients with Crohn's disease, this huge number of patients with Crohn's disease, actually reported bowel urgency. And not surprisingly, bowel urgency was higher among patients with active disease as compared to those in remission. But I want you to remember these numbers. 87% of those with active disease, but still 48% of patients in remission in this very large cohort actually had bowel urgency. So again, that unmet need. When we looked to try to correlate this with other factors, you'll see on the left, bowel urgency was associated with worsened social satisfaction, more fatigue, sleep disturbance, just as our patient in the example scenario is having, pain interference, anxiety, depression. So all of these different promise measures that are linked and have been validated for these PROs. Even when you look on the right-hand side, these are the group of patients who are actually in remission. And even in remission, bowel urgency is associated with each of these factors. So again, an unmet need for us to address. And next, I'd like to hear a little bit about this in McCall's own words so that we can take some of her points home.
Whenever I was originally diagnosed, when I knew I could no longer take care of myself, I truly was going probably every 45 minutes. Like if that, I would go to class and on my way back home, I would have to stop in the library bathroom because I have literally marked down every bathroom from Oklahoma City where my family lives to Norman. I know all the good bathrooms to stop at on campus. I had to teach myself that in order to avoid having an accident in public, which seemed so scary at the time. And now now I avoid it, but at the time it was fairly normal. Like in the beginning, I was in this show outside of OU. I was in this show and it got to the point where being in the rehearsal of this show was the only thing that could take my mind off of how sick I was feeling. But along with that came the fact that I was literally 20 years old in the production of this show, and I like had to wear diapers under my costume. And that's like something you never would think about. And no one around me knew that, but the fact that I knew that, and I knew that like at 20 years old, I had to go through this. This was pre-colon removal. It was just like, it was really, really challenging. And I've had moments like that post, like after my reversal, when I was just like really, really feeling sick. And I was like, I cannot do this. I have to sleep in a diaper tonight. I don't know what I'm going to do. And that's like, that's really challenging. I mean, it really has an impact. And I think I've been able to look at it more positively. But I think for the vast majority of people, that can be really terrifying.
It's terrifying to hear the impact on McCall.
Yeah. So we've had a few nice comments that I want to shout out, that people are very, really grateful that we're having this conversation. And seeing her story probably is the most important part of this, because I think it makes it all real for us. And it's really these college students, and we all, you particularly have college students.
A lot of college student patients.
And that I tend to, again, have these dialogues that I'm in a dorm. Mm-hmm. There's one bathroom. I need to wear a diaper. Yeah. And it wasn't until sometimes, because we may not have asked, it's when we go to do the examination, they're in our office, and I'm like, are you wearing, you know, a diaper? Mm-hmm. And she says, that's the only way I could stay in class, or I could stay in my dorm. Mm-hmm. I need to be at school.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I had a patient tell me once, you know, she has Crohn's disease, and her bowel had healed, and we were talking about being in remission, and she's like, I don't know what remission means. And I kind of, she told me that, you know, I still, when my friends, there's a lake near campus in Chapel Hill, and my friends go out to the lake on the weekend, and I don't feel comfortable going on a boat, because I can't wear protection, I may have urgency. And it just floored me, because her scope looked good, but we still had to fix this. And so when she finally got on the boat on the weekends, that's when we knew she was in remission, and it was from really addressing her urgency.
So how do we bring the conversation to make patients, you said that she was, most of the time it's because of embarrassment, you know, plus half the time, you know, our hands on the doorknob waiting already because we had 15 minutes and we know we have five patients waiting. And so how do you have this empathetic conversation when you know that they're waiting for us to bring it up? They think patients feel it's embarrassing and they don't want to be the only one. There's a lot that goes into that. So since you've been involved in these mm-hmm. conversations, have you proactively asked that in your EPIC dropdown?
Well, it'd probably be smart if I actually did a pre-survey and got at this information. But instead, what I do is I just try to normalize it. You know, often you do your chatting, you say hello, and then you say, well, how are you? You know, they usually say fine, they're college students. And then you kind of dig in and you say, well, you know, I'm going to run through a list of normal symptoms, you know, associated with inflammatory bowel disease, and I'm asking everyone, I want to know if you have any of this. You know, what's your bowel frequency? Are you having blood? Are you having pain? Are you having urgency? We just need to start doing it. And even before, there are some wonderful tools that you're going to teach us about, and I think implementing those is the gold standard. But us bringing this up, I think, is step one.
Yeah. So how did you approach McCall?
Yeah, no, I think patients like McCall and some of our other patients are our best teachers. I think mm-hmm. we can learn a lot from our textbooks and guidelines, but when we see these patients every day, we learn a lot from them. And McCall has taught us a lot, and not only her, but patients like her. And I think one of the critical things that you were asking about, how you incorporate in your 15-minute, 10-minute follow-up visits, it's also educating your staff, because many of us have scribes, MAs, roomers who room the patients, and if sometimes they can be a great help. And mm-hmm. and we, McCall, and there was another patient about 10 years ago that really, really touched us, because it's a very sad story, and I'll just very briefly tell you, a 19-year-old with increased symptoms come to us, we took care of him, and he got better, and he came to us, and he was so happy with his mom that I'm getting a job at Sam's Club, and I'm going to start tomorrow. And I'm so happy, and I'm very thankful that you started me on this advanced therapy. 3 weeks later, we heard that he passed away. He committed suicide, and we were just shocked. Found out that it was his first day at Sam's Club. He was a cashier, and he just had an accident, and he just could not take it. He just could not take it. So we went back. We were just discussing and kind of like self-learned ourselves that how important these symptoms are, and sometimes we just tend to ignore. Oh, okay, well, we'll address this. Well, we're more focused on your calprotectin. We need to be getting your colonoscopy set up, and we'll talk about it once we get more tests done, without realizing that that's what their immediate needs are. So I think these patients have really taught us about addressing the issues that probably we were not addressing, especially urgency in Crohn's disease. So I think, and then I think the big challenge right now, and I think you're going to teach us today, is how do you assess bowel urgency? Because everyone has their own definition of bowel urgency also. So I think we're going to learn that also today, about how do you ask and frame that question and get that information out of the patient.
I mean, also, Millie, thank you. Millie, you noted that you're just asking. So do you have to wear any diapers or protective garments during the day, at night? Ask it. It needs to be normalized. And I think Millie and I had a meeting we were at, and it was all about, there was a conversation around sexual health, and both of us were like, as female physicians especially, it's shameful that we are not approaching this like we ask about all other aspects. Right. And you showed, and bowel urgency. So the next question.
Highly linked.
How is this affecting your, you know, your sexual, your intimate relationships? Are you in a relationship? Have you avoided a relationship because of concerns about intimacy and the impact of bowel urgency? And it was funny, you know, when you showed that abstract of TNF versus not.
Neither one got better. Yeah.
And no one gets better, but also it reminds me, I remember that presentation where people were in complete deep remission and their fatigue continued, right? So we were looking at these symptoms in isolation, saying we always thought that depression, anxiety, urgency, fatigue, the magic of our advanced therapies are just going to, like, you know, get rid of all of those symptoms that are due to having active inflammation. Boy, were we completely off. And so, you know, there was a lot of questions around sort of how do you bring it up, which we talked about. And one of the questions is, in someone who's in even histo healing, we'll get to that because you're going to talk to us.
He's going to teach us a lot.
Yeah.
It'll be great.
And one question is that, do you know if there's similar prevalence between UC and CD for urgency? Are we aware of sort of what's out there in terms of prevalence?
Yeah, absolutely. So our music study, we actually did a UC cohort as well. And the numbers are comparable, but believe it or not, slightly higher in Crohn's disease.
Which, again, totally counter to everything we learned in our textbooks in med school, by the way. So we just weren't asking the right questions, and we weren't understanding. So we're going to just do one audience response question here and then move in and hopefully answer it with some of the information, the data that we have. So which of the following assessments captures bowel urgency impact in patients with Crohn's disease? So we'll get back to that because I think it'll become pretty clear what we've been doing until 2023 has had absolutely zero ability to capture what we need to capture, which is kind of bananas. But anyways, all right, so this was interesting. So as part of some initiatives with some of the members of the International Organization of Inflammatory Bowel Disease and others, as we start to move into creating a framework to actually capture this very impactful and burdensome symptom, they look back to see across all clinical trials how urgency was defined and whether there was a standardized way of measuring urgency. And the good news is that the majority, 20 of whatever the 28, never defined it and weren't even asking about it. So, I mean, that sort of, I think, was the drop the mic moment to know that, well, this is not where we want to, we don't want to repeat bad history. But you can see across the board, some defined it as asking them if they didn't make it in time, some that they couldn't defer for more than 15 minutes. Who knows why 15 minutes determines whether it's urgent or not. That's arbitrary. Maybe 5 minutes, and also just, do you have an urgency to go to the bathroom? Again, undefined. What does that even mean? And I would even venture to tell you that none of them measured the severity. And that's really the key distinguishing characteristic of the urgency NRS. But it was really about how severe was your urgency. And I think the measure, and even, you know, with some of our trials and in our clinic, as noted, it's a yes-no answer, which doesn't really answer the question that we really want to solve for, which is how severe and how does it impact your daily living. And we've got some really cool qualitative type research that is also continuing to look at how we're describing the impact on their daily lives. So the barriers to identified bowel urgency in Crohn's disease in particular is, does normal stool frequency mean no bowel urgency? We've always made that connection, that stool frequency. But I always tell my patients and listen and validate that this is like terrible. Like, really validate that what they're feeling is just awful, you know, and what they're experiencing. And you know, patients would say to you, and they've told us all, I'd rather have 5 controlled bowel movements that I can make it to the bathroom than 1 bowel movement that resulted in an accident. Yeah. Just one. You just need one as an IBD patient to forever change your life. And unwinding or, you know, moving beyond that without understanding the impact of that event on someone's life is really critical for us to make that connectivity. And here is just the effect that many patients, the majority here, slightly more than half, have no change in stool frequency, which again gets to the fact that we're asking about stool frequency in our PROs for clinical trials. That's what we're asking, is stool frequency, rectal bleeding, UC, stool frequency, and abdominal pain and Crohn's. Never does it say about urgency again. And so we talked about it in the question. There was specifically other things. And right now, just remember, what I'm showing you here are the currently used, at least 3 out of the 4, the Harvey-Bradshaw is not typically integrated into clinical trials. But for Crohn's disease, the Crohn's Disease Activity Index for clinical response, clinical remission, the IBDQ for purposely health-related quality of life, validated measure, questions that get to some fatigue and some urgency, double-barrel questions, really not asking about severity, and of course PRO2, which is, again, stool frequency and abdominal pain. That's it. So the currently, those that were up until really, truth be told, until the mirikizumab. For Crohn's disease, there has never the validated and what's thought to be regulatory-based indices to judge whether treatments actually get approval and meet the endpoints that are predefined. They didn't ask a patient whether this is what actually they want their drug to be approved for. But again, moving beyond that, you could tell, like, I'm crazy about this story. So none of them actually capture bowel urgency severity. That was sort of the concept. But what finally came into play, which again was really introduced in UC first, and what we learned about the urgency numeric rating scale, and this is a 11-point scale, which asks specifically about the severity of the urgency and a score of 0 to 10, 10 being obviously worst possible. It is asked the severity in the last 24 hours. How it's calculated, I'm going to show you some data in the clinical trials. I was really looking at a weekly average score over the previous 7 days when we're asking them to go back and at the study endpoints and look back over the last 7 days. And the higher score obviously indicates, as noted, worse bowel urgency. So, again, just noting this is against a binary yes-no scale, and that's what I think is really the, to me, that was the evolution of understanding urgency. So, setting the stage, so we all know the answer to that question, obviously, was that none of them really focused on severity until the urgency NRS. So, why, and at the fact that every single organization got latest guidelines really tells us that we need to be asking about urgency, but it took up until a more recent clinical trial to really tell us that we can measure it and we can successfully show change, right? So the other part of the story is incontinence. I mean, that has not been studied and we haven't, you know, validated a measure. Mm-hmm. But I think when you showed the impact on quality of life, and I had made a point that just one episode of incontinence really sets the stage for your journey. I asked that in general, I say in my drop down, after asking about urgency, yes, no, until mm-hmm. more recent, then I would say, have you ever an accident or episode of incontinence, but I definitely wasn't following that up with, do you wear a diaper at least once a week to work? And in New York, because there's, you know, subways, for example, we have not an insignificant amount of patients that are actually unable to go and get to work and don't use public transportation. And because they don't have a bathroom or access, so there are. So when I asked Lori and was told her that I'm so like Lori Kiefer, who's like genius PhD health psychologist, and I said, I can't believe that I've never, you know, I was like, again, psychotic about my lack of attentiveness to patients' burden symptoms. She goes, yeah, but that's what they tell me. I said, why don't they ever tell me that? She's like, well, that's what they tell me every day. People are using diapers to go on the MTA. You know, this is just how their life is. And they didn't think you could do anything about it. And so I ask probing questions and get into how they're actually living their best life, yes or no. Do you feel in control of your disease? That's when I get the information, because this tells me they feel they don't have control over their life, right? They don't have control over their bowel. We love to see that there's actually FDA guidance on the fact in Crohn's that we should be looking at it. Here is, you know, again, some guidance on, and there is other PROs that we know. There's a 6CD score, as well as a CDPRO-SS, which really Peter Higgins has been a strong advocate for in driving that forward. But again, the real one that really speaks to sort of the concept of measuring it in a validated manner, as noted. This is, again, just showing you the NRS as a sort of, as we think about it in the scale over 24 hours. And we're doing some work to show that even in the last 24 hours could really be that on its own, not in the trial where we had 7 days and looked at the severity and the average. But even just asking in the last 24 hours, that's probably just enough to actually move us in the direction of making a change. What I do want to highlight is, as part of the psychometric evaluation, as we were working through and looking at the data, you could see this was participants that registered full range of weekly average UNRS from 0 to 10, showing you at week 0 and at week 12. You want to make sure that this scale is responsive to change, that when you actually do an intervention, that you can measure that there's a meaningful change and that it responds. Any type of PRO, any type of biomarker, it has to be responsive. You have to be able to measure it, and you have to be able to see impact. And so it was really shown that that weekly data was really able to summarize the UNRS across a range. And what I'd like to show you, and the good news is, at baseline, before intervention, the light blue was in the higher scores, and the good news is that after you gave an intervention at 12 weeks, you had the darker blue being towards 0, 1, 2, so you saw that there was a change, right? An important, meaningful change, right, to say that this therapy actually made a difference. And a lot of people will ask us when we're talking about this topic, well, what's a meaningful change? I mean, does going from 10 to 9 mean much? Actually, we were pretty surprised at some of the data that even a 1-point change is actually something a patient values. So it was, again, a very eye-opening experience to sort of work on reading some of the qualitative data on what's changed. But in general, if you wanted to look at it, it looked like at least a 3-point change was probably the most meaningful for patients and applicable to how you and I would maybe use this mm-hmm. in clinical practice. So at the end of the day, We all know, and Millie have sort of made a case around why urgency matters, but I think the only voice that really was necessary and impactful was hearing from the patient themselves. We could show data till the cows come
right.
home, but unless you hear it directly from a patient, and I hope that all of you were shook sort of when she said, as you know, how she needed to wear her diaper really to sort of live her life and get to school and not miss class, and had to find a bathroom and map them out from Oklahoma City to Norman. You know, just these are things that stick with us. So I think, you know, understanding that we're moving away from do you have urgency, and that is just the start of the conversation, and
right.
then how severe it is, how much it impacts your daily life, are you engaging in intimate relationships, et cetera, more so than sort of trying to figure out, but this is not possible, your rectum's not involved, why are you having urgency? I got a lot of questions around, like, what's the pathophysiology.
Oh, we're going to hear about that.
We're going to hear about it. So the best part is you now.
Okay,
so we're going to move to you, and you're going to walk us through through also some treatment planning.
Yeah, I think that's kind of like a little bit daunting task also, because we're learning the burden of urgency. We are learning how critical it is to incorporate the assessment of urgency very recently now. So how do we package it together and bring it to our clinical practice, and what can we do in our practice and how we can manage it? I'll share some of the suggestions and proposals that we put it together, but I think there's a lot of work that needed to be done so that we can bring this to our guidelines and make a better strategy to manage fecal urgency in our patients. So one last video of McCall that we're going to share here.
When I think about success with bowel urgency, I think it's very different for every person. The same with how Crohn's and colitis and like everything is very different with every patient. For me in particular, because so much of my world has to do with acting and theater, that's how I was kind of measuring my success in things, was that there were times, like I stated before, where I was in a show and I literally couldn't get through the show was 50 minutes long, and I couldn't get through the duration of the 50 minutes without having to go to the bathroom. And sometimes I could, but the fact that I didn't know that if I could even make it 50 minutes meant that I had to wear a diaper during the production. And for my senior year of college, I was in a production both in the fall and in the spring. And in the fall production, I did the entire hour and a half with no diaper. I got through it just fine. And that was an incredible success for me. And then in the spring semester, I had to wear a corset in the show, which was hard enough before. And now it was really testing me. And I was also able to get through the entire production of the show, which was incredible. And it was able to give me pretty clear markers of knowing that I had started to figure things out, that my biologics were starting to work. And it had to do with also what I ate and when I ate. And that was a challenge, like knowing that if I had to eat, I couldn't eat directly before the production of the show, or I would have to go to the bathroom. So I had to make sure I ate 2 hours before the production, so I had time to digest the food for a little bit, because I still wanted to, like, you know, work myself up and not have to go to the bathroom immediately. So I would want to give myself that time. And then I would have to go to the bathroom directly before the show, so then I didn't have to go anytime after, which is still hard, because then you're sharing a dressing room with a bunch of people and then you have to go to the bathroom. So I would have to go upstairs and find the hidden bathroom so I could go to the bathroom with no one noticing and get back down in time to start the production of the show, which was a challenge every time, but it started to become easier and more manageable, and I was able to still be aware of the schedule, and I had to find my new normal, which was tricky, but also I've definitely started to navigate that more, whereas now it's kind of become, you know, a joke with among me and my friends and my boyfriend and my family, where if I can make it like 3 hours after a meal without going to the bathroom, we just celebrate.
So I think we hear these success stories from other patients also. What are their goals? What do they actually want out of the treatment? And that reminded me of another patient who, after a very successful treatment, comes to our clinic, and she's just laughing and giggling. And I ask her, like, okay, I got it that you're better, but why are you so happy? What did you achieve that made you so happy and you're just giggling? And she said that, you know, my kids, she had a 3-year-old and a 6-year-old. She said, my kid thought that bathroom is mama's room. And this is the first time I could live with my kids, read the story at night, sleep with them. And that was a huge impact for her because her kids thought that mama's room is the bathroom. So stories like this really reminds you about revisiting treatment targets. What are you trying to achieve here with your patients? And similarly, as we have been discussing Susie's case here, who have been impacted by urgency, and it's impacting her work, as you can see here. It's impacting her quality of life. She's fatigued. And then the last thing that we also learned about Susie is that she's almost at the verge of social isolation here. So it's really negatively impacting the social behavior of our patients. So if you ask Susie, she wants to have a work shift without interruption. She wants to have less bowel movements or going to the restroom at nighttime. And she wants to enjoy life. She wants to socialize. These are her treatment goals. And patients like McCall and Susie, they're not far-fetched from what rest of the patients want. And actually, this is a study that I'm sharing with you. It's a study by our colleagues from Barcelona. And what they did was, this was an observational study, and they asked the patient, what's the most important treatment targets? And you can see that 40% of the patients wanted their quality of life to be improved. And 33% of the patients wanted complete resolution of the symptoms. And pain and urgency being the two most important symptoms in Crohn's disease, they wanted to be having a complete resolution, as opposed to only 13% of the patients who wanted their colonoscopy to be normal. And if you remind ourselves, I mean, we are all about mucosal healing, normalization, endoscopic improvement, but that's true. But we need to realize that there are other aspects in IBD that we need to address to these patients. So how do we package this all together? As we started our discussion about, number one, assessing the bowel urgency, and there are different tools, and we learned today about the urgency numerical rating scale to assess accurately not only the presence of urgency, but also the severity of urgency. And then the second thing we probably need to assess is the inflammation. Is the inflammation present, or the urgency symptoms are without inflammation? If the inflammation is present and it's not controlled, we all know that we need to optimize therapy. We may need to initiate more effective therapy to those patients. But what about those patients who have no inflammation or no signs of inflammation? Their calprotectin is normal. Their endoscopy is normal, just like Miss Susie we were discussing today, who had a normal appearing endoscopy, but yet she is suffering from all these symptoms. So that's where the role of other non-inflammatory pharmacological and non-pharmacological interventions play a role. There is a role for dietary modifications. We'll learn about how low FODMAP diet can play a role here. Certain medications, such as antidiarrheal medications, bile acid sequestrants, tricyclic antidepressants, and perhaps even a role of pancreatic enzymes, that we will share some data on that. Anorectal dysfunction is also very common, and we need to address that. We need to investigate that and then manage it through biofeedback therapy or pelvic floor physical therapy. We'll touch base on that also. And lastly, the psychosocial support. That's critical. We all need experts like Lori Kiefer in all our practices. Mental health is extremely, extremely important when we are addressing our patients and improving their quality of life. So psychotherapy, giving them tools to develop strategies to cope with these stressors are critical in the management of these patients. So let's start with a dietary modification or dietary intervention. So you have a patient who is complaining of bowel urgency and stool frequency, has no inflammation, like our patient Susie. So limiting their highly fermentable oligosaccharides, disaccharides, monosaccharides, and polyols, or FODMAPs. These high FODMAPs have been shown to have various physiological effects on the gut, and they can produce a lot of symptoms, including bowel urgency, bloating, and diarrhea also. So limiting your FODMAPs can have a positive impact. And in fact, there is a study. This is a study from UK. And in this study, a single-blinded study, all patients who had quiescent IBD, but they had ongoing gut symptoms. And about 52 of these patients were enrolled in this study, and all were given either a four-week course of low FODMAP diet or sham dietary advice. And as you can see in the results here, that their IBS symptom severity scale did not change, but the gut symptoms really improved. And you can see that there's a significant difference in patients who were given 4 week of low FODMAP trial versus sham dietary advice. So it really helped improve their symptoms. The same group from UK actually did another study. It was another double-blind crossover study where a very interesting design. So these are the patients who were in remission or had quiescent IBD, and they were having functional gastrointestinal symptoms. And they were given low FODMAP diet for at least 2 weeks. And those who responded were then challenged with FODMAPs. And not only challenged with FODMAPs, they were challenged with different fermentable carbohydrates, as you can see here, fructans and galacto-oligosaccharides and sorbitol and glucose. And in a random fashion. And you can see here that it's the fructan in the FODMAP that is driving those symptoms, including bowel urgency, more compared to the other. So perhaps something to consider that if your patients cannot do low FODMAP diet or has done low FODMAP diet and they want to reintroduce food, perhaps cut down or minimize the fructans component of those fermentable carbohydrates to see if they can it can help with their urgency. When it comes to the pharmacotherapy, besides the dietary intervention, let's talk about pharmacotherapy now. So antidiarrheals, such as loperamide, has been shown to improve bowel urgency that is caused by both inflammatory and non-inflammatory mechanisms. Loperamide can normalize your colon transit time, and it's thought to increase the internal anal sphincter tone also. And actually, there are studies that have shown that loperamide decreases several gastrointestinal functional symptoms, such as fecal urgency, frequency, and it can also improve stool consistency. And this is a very interesting and intriguing study, a very old study published in 95, in patients with Crohn's disease. The group actually administered 2 milligrams of loperamide as a loading dose, and then for 1 week, these patients were given 1 milligram of loperamide oxide after each unformed bowel stool, and they were followed for 1 week. And after 1 week, those who responded were then given 1 milligram of loperamide oxide twice daily for another 1 week. And what the group discovered that after 1 week of taking loperamide, both the investigators and the patient's evaluation for global efficacy were in favor of loperamide, and patient-reported severity of diarrhea also improved with loperamide. Also, it helped with abdominal pain. After 2nd week, where they were given 1 milligram of loperamide oxide twice daily, although it did not reach statistical significance, both investigators and patients' assessment of global efficacy and symptom improvement, including urgency, continued to be in favor of loperamide. So, very interesting study showing the impact of a very simple over-the-counter medication that can help in these patients. What about the role of tricyclic antidepressants? We have learned a lot about tricyclic antidepressants, especially amitriptyline in our IBS patients for pain and diarrhea. And this is a study that is, I think, again from UK, the group of, it was a study done by the surgeons for idiopathic fecal incontinence. About 44% of these patients who had fecal incontinence were also reporting urgency. And these patients were given amitriptyline, 20 milligram, for 4 weeks. Just recall that in the United States, we have the different doses of amitriptyline, and it does not have an FDA approval to be used for fecal urgency. But in this study, when they were given 20 milligram of amitriptyline for 4 weeks, and after 4 weeks, patients were evaluated for fecal incontinence scores, a number of bowel movements, and some other anorectal manometric measurements. And what they witnessed that after 4 weeks of getting amitriptyline, 20 milligram, there was improvement in the scores for incontinence as well as bowel frequency. And not only that, if you look at some more details, and especially the last box, you will see that their rectal motor complexes, their median number of these rectal motor complexes actually reduced. Their median anal pressure improved, and the rectal pressure decreased. So actually improving the rectal compliance and increasing the anal pressure. So again, there is a potential role for tricyclic antidepressants such as amitriptyline in these patients who are suffering from urgency or fecal incontinence. Then what about bile acids? There's another physiologic changes that can happen in our, or pathologic changes that can happen in our IBD patients, where we can get bile acid malabsorption. Bile acid malabsorption can happen for many reasons in our IBD patients. It could be because of the small bowel surgery, resection, inflammation, and even the dysbiosis in your colon can yield to an altered bile acid pool, where in a normal bile acid pool, you see a lot of secondary bile acids, but if it is abnormal due to many reasons, including disturbed or disrupted enterohepatic cycle of bile acid metabolism, you get a lot of primary bile acids, and they can lead you to have more frequency, urgency, and more symptoms. And in fact, one of the tests that can be done to check for bile acid malabsorption is CCAT, not very widely used in clinical practices, but this study actually showed that 90% of the patients who had bowel resection in Crohn's disease, and majority of these patients had ileocecal resection, 90% of these patients had bile acid malabsorption. And even in the absence of bowel resection, almost 30% of these patients had bile acid malabsorption for other reasons. So bile acid malabsorption is something that we may need to keep in mind when we are assessing urgency in patient like Ms. Susie, who is in remission when it comes to inflammation, but is still suffering from symptoms like urgency. What about pancreatic enzymes? So exocrine pancreatic insufficiency has been shown to be present in patients with IBD. Studies have shown that reduced fecal elastase can be present in about 18% of our patients with IBD, and there are many reasons why they can have exocrine pancreatic insufficiency. Very rarely our IBD patients can have pancreatic problems also. But in the absence of pancreatic pathology, they can still have EPI as measured by fecal elastase. But we do need to remind ourselves about the false positive right. fecal elastase that can happen because of the watery diarrhea that can dilute the elastase also. However, this is something that you may need to keep in mind and investigate. And in fact, the 2023 AGA clinical practice update on EPI does recommend that EPI should be considered in patients mm-hmm. with moderate risk clinical conditions such as Crohn's disease, and fecal elastase tests can be done. And if it is truly EPI and the test is positive, then consider pancreatic enzyme replacement therapy in those patients. So lastly, I will touch base on anorectal dysfunction. We learned about the anorectal dysfunction that can be caused by the inflammation, by proctitis, and other causes such as we learned about bile acid malabsorption and IBS and bacterial overgrowth, but poor rectal compliance, neurological causes of anorectal dysfunction, and anal sphincter dysfunction can also contribute to your anorectal dysfunction also. So this was a nice study. I think this is a study from Greece, and very interesting study, giving us the concept of how it can happen. So these were the patients, 41 patients with Crohn's disease, and these patients had, out of these group, they studied the group with no endoscopic inflammation, evidence of inflammation, but the biopsy-proven Crohn's disease. So negative endoscopy and positive histology. So they got 20 patients out of this pool of Crohn's disease patients who have negative endoscopy or normal endoscopy, but on histology there was inflammation. And what they discovered that in these patients who were in endoscopic remission, but histologically they were still positive, compared to the patients who had negative rectal pathology, like completely normal rectal pathology, completely normal rectum histologically, these patients who had evidence of histologically positive inflammation in a normal appearing rectum, they had lower anal resting and squeeze pressure. They had lower sphincter and high pressure zone length. The rectal sensation was affected. And some other anorectal manometry findings, such as ultra-slow wave amplitude and ultra-slow wave frequency, both were also lower in these patients. And rectal compliance was also reduced. So the study showed us that despite normal appearing rectum, since there was some presence of inflammation at the histologic level, it was affecting the rectal compliance. It was contributing to the anorectal dysfunction or dyssynergic defecation in these patients. And that is then exacerbated in the patients who now have active inflammation. So what do we do with these patients? So one thing for patients who have anorectal dysfunction, we can consider biofeedback therapy. So biofeedback is actually a self-regulation technique that we can teach to our patients to strengthen their pelvic floor muscles, to retain their rectal sensation, and coordinate pelvic floor muscles during evacuation. It typically consists of three phases. In phase one, you assess. You educate patients about the findings of anorectal manometry and explaining to them that what's wrong and what could be contributing to their urgency. Phase two, that entails active exercise and training phase, where not only you perform strengthening training to improve the external anal sphincter, you also improve the rectal sensory training, and you also do the coordination training to help coordinate and increase the threshold for urgency also. And then the last phase is where you can wean off these biofeedback trainings and then reinforcement according to the individualized need for that patient. So biofeedback is also something that we can consider in our patients where we have ruled out that there is no bile acid malabsorption, EPI, and they have anorectal manometry showing that there is an anorectal dysfunction. And anorectal dysfunction is actually prevalent in our IBD patients. This dyssynergic defecation is present in our patients, not only in patients who have had colectomy and J-pouch, but also in patients who are without surgery. So even in a patient without any surgical intervention, you can see that anorectal dysfunction or dyssynergic defecation is present in as high as 97% of these patients. And with patients who had J-pouch, it's also very commonly present. And then there is a response to these biofeedback therapy, and that response is quite impressive. 70 to 80% of these patients do respond to these biofeedback therapy. Pelvic floor training with or without biofeedback can also help with incontinence and urgency in patients with quiescent IBD. When we perform pelvic muscle contraction, so the pelvic muscle contraction strength, it can be diminished in shortened, tight, and tense muscles, and that can happen in an inflammatory condition and also when your muscles are weak, when you have pelvic floor muscle weakness. And that both can then affect the continence and the ability to evacuate. And patients who have gone these treatments have shown improvement in their symptom score, quality of life, and illness perception also. So lastly, it's a few other words about pelvic floor muscle training. It's just not a training where you're just strengthening the muscle. So it's not just Kegel exercises. Actually, in pelvic floor muscle training, it also incorporates exercises that improve patients' awareness of muscle contraction and relaxation. And it also helps them coordinate the abdominal diaphragm muscles for the normal function of continence and effective defecation. So in short, all these behavior treatment are tailored to an individualized patient symptoms, and it can include pelvic floor muscle training with and without feedback, biofeedback. It can also include some other behavioral treatments such as toileting modification, urge resistance, lifestyle changes, and more importantly, emotional support. And lastly, I think this is my last slide, on kind of like consolidating everything, what I just explained, that the important and critical thing is recognizing this, recognizing the presence and the impact of fecal urgency in our patients, explicit and empathetic inquiry of patients about urgency and how we can register this in our clinical notes and in our daily practices, and then providing them with emotional support, with social support, performing appropriate diagnostic investigations, offering them medical therapy, physical therapy, biofeedback therapy, and some other complementary therapy that can really help them improve their fecal urgency. So going back to Ms. Susie, who had these three treatment goals. Number one, how she can work. Same as we learned from McCall also, that she wanted to finish her shift or her practice, and also improvement the fatigue because of this nighttime awakenings. And the third goal of Miss Susie, that was preventing social isolation. So what we can offer to Miss Susie, we have already taken care of her inflammation. We have already optimized her therapy. The other things, just to summarize what we just discussed, Miss Susie can be offered anorectal manometry testing to see if there's any anorectal dysfunction or dyssynergic defecation. We can evaluate her for bile acid malabsorption. We can discuss with her a trial of amitriptyline, a low-dose amitriptyline. We can discuss about dietary modification. We can also assess her for depression and anxiety, and also a trial of loperamide that can also be considered in her case when we are managing patients' urgency like Ms. Susie. So that's where I'm going to end. It was a little bit to digest, but I think this was all we have learned, have practiced. It's just how do we put it together for our patients who are suffering from urgency.
Well, thank you. You've actually generated the most. We have almost 50 questions that have come in just from our discussions today. Many of them were complimenting the fact that this did not show any clinical trial data, did not talk about a drug name per se. This was focused on what matters most to patients. So I did want to say that that was like, and some had noted that everyone in an auditorium is engaged, and so there's groups of folks out there that are listening. And so before we start getting into some, there's some themes, so I'll break it up. But let's ask the question that we started the day off with, or the session off, which is now, I guess it's now after now. Hearing all of that, if the answer is not always, we haven't done our job, but now, how often will you incorporate bowel urgency assessments into your evaluation of a patient with Crohn's disease?
That's great.
Oh, thank you, everybody.
Our job is done.
You. All right, let's dig in. I know the people may still. This is amazing. Thank you, everyone. And really sees again, imagine when we first saw the data and we were involved in all of this, we're like, this is crazy. This is like something, how could 30 years later I be learning something completely I never even thought really was a thing? So that's what's the beauty about IBD is this continual learning experience. So, and hearing from our patients. So SMART goals, just as we wrap up sort of the purpose of and what we want to really manifest for it is proactively screen patients with Crohn's for bowel urgency symptoms using a meaningful assessment tool such as the UNRS. Yes, that is for sure, because we're kind of highlighting the fact that there's a severity measure here. But just asking a patient whether with Crohn's disease you experience urgency, I'd be happy with, like, just low bar, right?
Low bar and then dig in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then increase the percentage of patients who have an individualized plan to address bowel urgency during periods when inflammation is controlled. Seriously, like, your part, although, like you noted, it's a lot, it's so critical because there's myths around don't use antidiarrheals because you may have toxic mega, whatever the concepts around. So there's a lot of questions about loperamide. Wow. So, and improve the proportion of patients with Crohn's who identify their goals for addressing the impact of bowel urgency and other CD symptoms on daily life. So, you know what? Another emotion which makes me so happy is that there were many responses that said, wow, I'm going to start asking the question, and now I have some answers, because I wasn't asking because I didn't know what to do with it. So it really, and it made people have an epiphany. So I'm really grateful that you guys were so helpful at this. So tell me about the loperamide story and the FODMAP. There was some question about, you know, do you have a certain amount of time that you would say take loperamide? Is it loperamide as needed or always and forever? Tell us a little bit more about how you think about antidiarrheals.
So the way I think now, after learning about this and from some of my experiences also, I'm not that scared about loperamide that probably I was many years ago. Once you start an effective therapy and you know that the inflammation is getting checked, I actually, in my practice, I have started using low-dose loperamide in these patients to help them give more control to their bowel, especially learning that loperamide can have really good effect on the anal sphincter and the rectal compliance. So actually, it goes along, and there are some actually studies, I was digging deep into loperamide stories, that how it affects the sodium channels on the opioid receptors and can even modulate some of the inflammation. But this is all theoretical. I mean, it's not like we don't have studies to prove that, and that's not the take-home message here. But there's some concept about that it's not as dangerous as it used to be. In my practice, I use scheduled loperamide because I tell my patients, if you have a accident or a bowel movement or an episode and you're taking loperamide, it's kind of like putting the
cart before the horse.
So perhaps just do a schedule one. If you are suffering from nighttime accidents or early morning, just take one loperamide at night. I mean, some of the patients do complain to me that they get really constipated, and I tell them take baby loperamide. Just get the liquid one that we use for babies and just use that a little bit, or just titrate and play with it a little bit to see. All I need is to have you a little bit more control for your incontinence and urgency.
So, Millie, how do you?
Well, so I actually do, you know, many of us have been using loperamide for a long time, particularly in our pouch patients or patients who've had surgery, et cetera. But one of the things you have to do is you have to tell your patient, you know, when they go to buy this at the pharmacy, on the bottle it clearly says, do not take regularly.
Yeah.
And I emphasize to my patients, that's because we don't want someone who is undiagnosed out there having terrible diarrhea who hasn't sought investigation. We know where your diarrhea comes from. We know your inflammation is under control. There's no danger to you in chronically using this. I think we have to emphasize that because every bottle is marked that way. And we want that because we want to be able to diagnose patients appropriately. But remember that we have 40, 50 years of data surrounding chronic loperamide use in post-surgical states. So
okay, we're up to 60. So we're going to be here all night. Just kidding. So probably the most important comment was that someone wants my shoes. I thought I should just say that. So someone virtually, thank you. But that was a really important comment. So I think that really, we should just end it right there. No, I'm kidding. Okay. So how do we tell a patient and validate that this is not acceptable? And how do you separate that, this endo remission, historemission, but yet patients, you know, we need to bridge that gap, but tell them that we could do better? How do you message that to your patients?
It's a hard message, and I think I try to have the patient help me to get there, because some of my patients, they come in, they say, what's remission? I don't know what remission is. They've never actually been well since their diagnosis. And so coming up with what remission means to them, and then it often is these factors. It's the quality of life. It's going to dinner with friends. It's not having to map out every bathroom like McCall did. And so we say, okay, here's the goal. How are we going to get there? Number one is controlling the inflammation. But then we know that we need to continue to address the other steps until we get to that individualized remission. And I think that has really helped me, because oftentimes what you hear from your patients, it's not, you know, two bowel movements. It's not CDAI. It is very much other factors that mean remission to them.
And I would just echo the same thing, that number one, we need to... how you frame your question and how you're asking these questions and how you're describing your management goals. And I learned hard way about 6 years ago when I was writing my first book for Crohn's and Colitis for Dummies. I had a technical editor who would just come to me every evening and ask me, what does the inflammation mean? And it never occurred to me that even the word inflammation, patient may not even know. They can confuse inflammation with infection and or many other things. So making sure that what you're saying to your patient, the patient is understanding that.
Right.
And then the second thing, I think you can't just do it by yourself. You need to have a team, a support team, to help your patient. So I really truly believe that when you're caring for an IBD patient, you need a team, a strong supporting team that is helping them. Not only that 15-minute visit will not do justice to those patients.
Remember, care really happens when they leave the office.
Yes. Yeah. Right.
And then they're left to self-manage, often trying to find what's on the internet.
Yeah.
And if we're not, you know, we believe ourselves to be the center of truth. If we're, you know, in essence, we're like, don't believe everything you
right.
read on the internet. But we have to have solutions. So they wouldn't want to look for, you know, patients in general aren't self-managing if they had the information and felt empowered that they were in control. So I think the more we can do to sort of validate and say we could do better and here are some ways.
Right.
There's a lot of questions on fatigue. You showed in music that fatigue and urgency. Dave Rubin showed at DW fatigue and urgency in the UC population. They're related. Does that come into this holistic approach? Should we be thinking of fatigue, urgency, pain? You showed the bubbles of those
right.
PROs.
Yeah. I think absolutely, and they're very much interrelated. I mean, if you're getting up at night and not having good sleep hygiene because you're going to the bathroom because you're having urgency, it's clearly going to affect your fatigue. It's all interrelated. This came up with sexual health and sexual dysfunction, very much interrelated with the fear of urgency. And so I think that as we address each of these components, the others will potentially improve as well.
You know, there was a question around women in particular, and I want to mm-hmm. just add my two cents around pelvic floor, and
yeah.
we don't ask enough. Again, this
yeah.
goes back to the sexual quality of life or sexual dysfunction, but it's more... there's a huge relationship between this pelvic floor dysfunction and someone who has a lot of urgency, who is, you know, constantly brain gutting or brain anal sphincter thought process about the anxiety around it, and just constant state of sort of squeezing your, you know,
right.
the pelvic floor and the sphincters, that we absolutely underestimate the impact of IBD on the pelvic floor. And I have women who come to me for preconception counseling, and I routinely will ask about vaginismus, painful intercourse. There's a whole discussion around that as well. And a lot of it is even my discussion about C-section mm-hmm. versus vaginal delivery in a woman who has severe pelvic floor. There's a lot we do not dive into, and
right.
it is very much intimately tied to urgency. And so I think there's a lot more to be done. I feel like we have a lot of work, but we just started to scratch the surface, clearly, because, like, finally we're talking about it, for God's sakes. We had to wait for an anonymous survey to actually ask the question. We weren't doing it ourselves. I mean, that's insane, too. So, again, we've had a lot of epiphanies over the last, like, 4 or 5 years around this Confide survey in particular and some of the work in music. And so talk about the scale and how we measure. So point number one from the SMART goals. We showed that there was a 7-day and then there was an average. I would like to share that just asking 1 day's worth of urgency is probably enough. Do you, and there was a lot of questions. I want to ask this question, can my MAs or can my nurses, should we just integrate this into EPIC?
If you have an EPIC pre-question survey, if you normally take in a new patient visit where you get a detailed history that they write things down, ask them. You know, it can be used in a couple of different fashions. When we used it in music, and as they did in the clinical trial, a 0 or 1 is considered bowel urgency remission, and everything else, obviously is having urgency. But there's a lot of use in being able to understand where on the scale they are, because that severe urgency, as Marla mentioned, bringing someone down even 3 points into moderate can have a dramatic impact on their quality of life. So it's something you can longitudinally track, and it's very easy to do. It's self-explanatory. Patients get it. It's a scale. They circle where they are.
Yeah, not only patients can do that. You can very easily integrate in your EMR through a SMART phrase or something and actually develop this, and it's very easy. Mm-hmm. I mean, developing an HBI or CDI, I mean, that's a nightmare to develop in, for example, an EPIC tool. Yeah. But this is so easy. It's just numeric, and you can even find this and just do that, and your scribe, your MA can do it. And the cool thing, as you're saying, is that you can celebrate when you see the scale is improving. Yeah. And you can see, like, oh, look, your urgency is improving, and that's something we should celebrate. So I think that's...
And you could ask them, and just as Marla said, the question could be in the past 24 hours, how has your urgency been? But you can also say in the past week, consider an average 24-hour period. You don't need the daily measurement. Yeah. It can still be utilized.
Yeah, we showed that just asking that sort of equates to or averages out. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the fact that you can measure, and I showed that, you showed a difference at 0 to 12, for example. We knew that at least a 3-point change. So now all of us could sort of put that on our radar if we were to integrate it and ask 0 to 10. And next visit, and you write down that it's a 9, and then shortly thereafter, just like you're measuring rectal bleeding, whether you're measuring stool frequency, what does it matter? Now you're asking about bowel urgency severity. I've just added it now to how I feel I am moving in the right direction with this therapy. And actually, the UC Miri Lucent trials are published in the New England Journal, and we measured bowel urgency remission, so 0, 1, 2. So if you looked at, you could see what was defined as remission, because there was a lot of questions around defining remission, and we'll have that in some as the Crohn's data starts to come out. There was a lot of questions about, has other therapies applied the UNRS? I noted, so for example, etrasimod, there is data in UC applying the urgency NRS. TL1A, the Prometheus, now Merck asset, also use the UNRS. So you're going to start to see a lot more application of it to a point where it's going to become standard. And so the beauty is that you can get ahead of it and be ahead of the curve, because you really heard sort of the importance and some of the nuances around it. There was also about, because they're asked whether the FDA, and so I think really the fact that all this tremendous work has been done to actually validate it was a huge lift, and I think a huge value add to the community. So I think it's important that we can start to dive in and really think about how to capture it. Now, there was a question, so does that mean that I should be optimizing my therapies based on urgency? I think tell me how you approach that, and what's your bar to say, I need to optimize the therapy, or do I do everything you just told me to do?
Well, I think you're not practicing in, like, silos. We're not just using symptoms alone. We're using biologic markers, whether that be a calprotectin, or maybe you've scoped them, or, Marla, I'm going to say it, Perhaps you've done an intestinal ultrasound to assess objectively whether they have inflammation. So I think when we put all the pieces of information together, it helps you to determine that. But remember what I showed you in our music study where, yes, people who had active disease, 87% of them had urgency, but among those in remission, it was still 48%. And so there, it's not a direct correlation. So I think we need to understand in relation to other testing as well. I don't know how you, if you would agree testing.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And sometimes you just have to do it together, concomitantly, where you're offering the therapy, optimizing the therapy, and just understanding it could be as simple as just introducing low FODMAP diet while you are starting a new therapy. Or it could be as simple as if you feel like this is a pelvic floor issue, just sending them for a physical therapist also. At the same time, you don't have to create a sequence or an algorithm. You can just see what your patient need and what we can do to help.
I've been impressed by how many patients actually respond to cholestyramine for bile acid malabsorption too. And I will actually often concurrently, particularly if they've had a prior resection, you know that's a component of this. So treating concurrently can help you to get
there. It's like 90%.
And yeah.
Even without resection, 30% of the patients had bile acid malabsorption.
A couple of points here is they said, you know, glass half empty, glass half full. Many patients still report urgency despite our fabulous advanced therapies and the depth of remission. And some folks are even proposing disease clearance. And we have patients who can't even leave their house. So how disconnected are we, really? I'm serious here. But it's interesting, the idea that the question was, you know, it just means that we don't have enough, we don't know how to really treat this symptom, but I think what I'm seeing is it's multifactorial, therefore you can't just assume, just like we assume one drug may be the solution to all people with IBD, it doesn't even make any sense. So I think the concept that this is multifactorial and therefore we need to have a more sort of holistic, as you noted, but holistic means the physical, the mental, the emotional, all of that needs to be in place. So I think you brought that out. One other point is with perianal Crohn's disease, we didn't, and we should have actually talked a little bit about it. I just got triggered because someone said is stem cell part of it, and it just made me realize thinking about perianal fistulas. But a lot of our patients who've lost, if there's a defect in the wall of the sphincter, they may have these issues as well. So part of it is also aggressively, please treat the perianal disease, and that's for another day because we're actually... Crazy, 70 questions. It's amazing. So thank you, everybody.
So Marla, I know you're about to wrap up, but I want to give a call out. She's not here with us, but I just wanted to say a thank you to McCall, if she happens to be among the virtual audience, because I think all of us learned so much from her. And Tasif, thank you for involving her in the program. And just, I think we've got to say that loud and clear.
No, absolutely. It's on my list.
Sorry. I didn't read the list, clearly. I didn't do my pre-homework.
You didn't do the homework. But anyways, no. I think what I feel is the bravery.
Yes. Yeah.
That to me is like really, you know, mission critical. So, again, thank you, everybody. Like, so being so engaged and so interested in the story is just really amazing for us because this is what, as noted at the beginning, this is what we do and why we do what we do. So really appreciate everybody's interest, particularly in my shoes. So today's activity, because I've had a number, by the way. So today's activity will be available on the Gastroenterology Hub on CME Outfitters website. And there's a whole bunch of other stuff also to go through on there that you'll really get some, see some great assets and information. And both of you, in addition to McCall, but yes, all of you for being here and staying here and virtually, and mostly the two of you, because really, you really took this program to a whole other level. So thank you, really.
Thank you.
Have a great rest of the night. Yeah.